one of the most acclaimed jazz albums of all time, turning 60 this year, Miles Davis' Kind of Blue. And we'll be talking about that and much more in a typically well-rounded conversation with our friend Colin Fleming, who joins us. Hello, Colin.
Why do I picture you cinching up your robe and nursing a highball with that place?
It's like you can see right through the phone.
Yeah, it must be one of those magical periscope phones. There it is.
Come on in. Nice to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. Well, before we get to Miles and before we talk about the Universal horror films, let's go back to one of the most interesting Red Sox teams that didn't win a doggone thing, the 84 Red Sox.
They didn't win, but they would have won if they were in the AL West. In fact, five teams in the AL East would have taken the AL West, and there were only the two divisions back then. But in the history of Red Sox teams, this is one odd squad. You have things happening in terms of the statistics of this team that's on the cusp in many ways of a team that's going to be a legitimate contender for the next few years. But man, do you have some statistical oddities popping here. For instance, you can have a Hall of Fame career as a primarily offensive player in baseball and never amass 300 total bases in the season. It's not that unusual. The Red Sox on this team had four guys get over 300 total bases, which is just, it's incredulity-inducing, really. Tony Armas had 339 total bases. You think, huh, how did he manage to do that? Because he only had 29 doubles, which is fair. It's not like some inordinate amount of doubles. He had five triples. He hit 268. So it's not like he was a Nelly Fox-like master of the single, and he had 43 home runs. The key to getting over 300 total bases for him and some of his mates was never, ever, ever walking. He walked 32 times that year. And Jim Rice, he was pretty close with 44 bases on ball. But between Tony Armas and Dwight Evans, you had two guys who almost totaled as many total bases as Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle on the 1961 Yankees, who were managed, of course, by Ralph Houk, the manager of this Red Sox team.
Yeah, you had three guys with 100 or more runs batted in. Armas, who people forget, won two-thirds of the Triple Crown that season.
Armas was still on the team when they made their push in 86. This is the last time he's going to be healthy. It's the last time he's going, I think this is year 30 season, the last time he's going to be a consistent power threat. You had Mike Easler, who is this forgotten Red Sox DH. He only had the 2 year stint with them. And Dwight Evans was in his late career prime, his entire prime, such as it was, happened late in his career. He wins the Gold Glove. And the best offensive player on the team is not in this list, Wade Boggs, a guy who, when you go back and you look at his career, it's a wonder that he didn't cop an MVP award at some point. And I don't think people understood how good Wade Boggs was at the time, how dominant he was. Now, he slipped, and this is his second year. The Red Sox didn't let him start. They kept him down in Pawtucket for a weird amount of time. So he hit 361 in 83. That's the last year with Yastrzemski, the passing of the torch type of deal. He slumps, quote-unquote slumps, to 325. But you have also Rich Gedmon, 24 home runs, 72 RBI, and OPS over 800 in the catcher slot. You have Marty Barrett emerging as the second baseman for the first time. Buckner is brought in. Remy is going out. Eckersley has absolutely nothing left, and he's shipped out of town. And here's another weird fact. Jerry Remy and Roger Clemens were teammates who appeared in exactly one game together with Remy pinch hitting. He didn't even start because his knees were gone. So you have a lot of strangeness going on. You have Ojeda, Bobby Ojeda, Bruce Hurst, and Oil Can Boyd all deciding to see who can come up with the craftiest version of the 12-12 record, because that's all what they had. It was just strange. And yet they were on the cusp of breaking through, but never having, of course, that ultimate breakthrough.
Yeah, Clemens at 21 with a fine year, a 9-4 record. But as a team, what did they end up with? 86 wins?
Yeah, it was 84, 86, something like that. So they're fourth place. They won back behind the Yankees. Toronto's pretty good. But it was that year where Detroit starts out whatever insane record they started out as. It's like 32-4. And then after that, they were fine. And the Blue Jays finished like 15 games back. In the West, you had a slightly above 500 Kansas City Royals team, and then everybody else was 500 or worse. So one of the things with baseball right now is that, yes, the games take forever. If you go through Baseball Reference, you look at what the Red Sox were doing night in, night out in 1984. You're seeing games that are 2 minutes and 2 hours and 20 minutes long. Granted, you're seeing only 10,000 people at Fenway Park, oftentimes, unless it's the Yankees game. But they're moving along at just a totally different pace, and you see it in those total base numbers and in the walk numbers, because guys were going up a hacking. They weren't mucking around at the dish. It was, I don't want to walk. Walks are for wussies. I want to hit my way on, and it was more of an athletic game, I think. If you watch like a hockey game from the 1980s, you see the saves that somebody like Grant Fuhr makes. It's exciting. The kick save and all of that, kick it out into the crowd. But it's not as efficient a way to play the position, just like this was not as efficient a way to score runs and win games. So more exciting, faster pace, and yet, where did it get them?
But I have an affinity, I think, for those teams that were fun to watch, and they were so much fun, even if they didn't win as many games or get to the postseason, to see an Al Nipper go out there for maybe one or two seasons in his career when he actually had some kind of value and put together a good season.
Remember, was this Roger Clemens' best friend?
Yes.
In the game? And yeah, this was the year of Nipper's life. He was 11-6 with a 3.89 ERA. And it's not like he was Satchel Paige dealing out there. But at least now you have the wild card, and that makes it more exciting, because this was just over so early. And I remember when I look back on this team in my memory, I thought of them as these pathetic also-rans, this kind of early 90s Patriots sort of team. And they weren't. They played a very lively offensive style. They finished with a better record than this year's dark, clotted Red Sox team is probably going to finish with. And yet, because of the way the divisions were aligned, there wasn't always a lot of drama. At least now you can be mediocre and you're in it up until probably September 1st. But yeah, they were exciting, and they were on the verge of becoming this team that really should have salted away a championship or two. But they were bringing it at the time.
I was down a little story. I was down in spring training that year, a part of my extended college career. So it was sort of a combined spring break and, oh, hey, I work at a radio station, so I'll get a press pass. And I basically just hung out and got good seats for games. Ralph Houk might as well have been retired for all he did around the team. I don't think I ever saw him get off the bench.
Sure, and he was there for a few years. It's not like, okay, Ralph, we're in between who the main guys are going to be. Could you pitch in Johnny Pesky style? It wasn't like that. And I thought at the time that this guy was Yoda. He looked a little like Yoda. He was in his early 60s. I mean, I don't know if that, like, he wasn't that great at aging, or people just looked like they were on the, just, you know, one little push and you're falling into the mausoleum back then. And he just, I think, wrote the lineup card, and that was what he did. But that's what he did with the 61 Yankees.
Right.
Even when Ralph Houk was in his early 40s prime, he was like Maris, third, Mantle, fourth, Yogi, fifth. Like, it probably was never that difficult for him.
Yeah. Skowron's on the bench, and he still hits 20. I'm a genius manager.
They were similar teams in a way. Like, that 61 Yankees team is a great team, is overrated. It's essentially the M&M boys doing their thing, and now you have the very poor man's version of the M&M boys, and you can pick your duo, whether it's Rice and Armas, Evans and Armas, Evans and Rice, Eastler and Rice, whatever it might be. But they were a team that you look at them and you think, and I don't think people were writing this at the time, that, hey, watch these guys next year. They had sort of been, they had 70s holdovers like Rick Miller and Gary Allenson. So they were still jettisoning dead weight, and they didn't become this new behemoth that they would be, the slugging Red Sox. They were always the slugging Red Sox, no matter what incarnation they were in, decade out. Strange.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, let's shift from baseball to horror films. And the folks at Shout Factory have released a terrific collection of some of those great Universal horror classics.
They have, and it's key to four films, and they all have Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff. And the two prime films, I would say, are The Raven and The Black Cat. And The Black Cat came out first. And these are both based. Based is a word that has absolutely no valence right here. I'm just using based. Off of stories by Edgar Allan Poe. And I would say that The Black Cat, which was directed by Edgar Ulmer, who later became the king of Poverty Row, where films were made on a $50,000 budget, if he was lucky, shot in 10 days. And your man, Peter Bogdanovich, did a great interview with him. I know he's coming on Friday,
yeah.
And that interview is in the book called Who the Devil Made It. And Ulmer is just such a BSer. He will lie to you about everything. It's like, sure, I built the sets for Metropolis. Fritz Lang went away, and I just got some hammer and nails. Okay, sure you did, big fella. With this film, I don't know if Ulmer had some demons in his life, but you have Bela Lugosi. He is going to visit his old friend. He doesn't mean it anything but sardonically. Boris Karloff, and he's going with David Manners, who's this milquetoast that was in Dracula. He's always the token male lead in these films, and his bride or bride-to-be, and their car goes off the road and all of this, and they end up at this mansion, and right away, Lugosi goes into his thing, because that's where Boris Karloff lives. And Karloff, he sold Lugosi's character down the river in the war, and he took his wife and his daughter. He got bored with the wife, so he murders her, then he embalms her, and he's like, hey, Bela, check this out, your wife. he's like, whoa, okay. And then Lugosi learns that his daughter's still alive, so he wants to rescue her. Karloff, who also finds ample opportunity to worship the devil with the devil cult in this film, he says, no, slow your roll there, bro. And he kills Lugosi's daughter just so he can't rescue her. It is one twisted film, and if the censorship board was in effect a few weeks later, there is no way that this could have come out. You have these Art Deco sets, and it looks beautiful. It was shot, no joke, by somebody named John J. Mezcal, who might as well have knocked back a big old liter of it, because no film from the Universal Horror Cycle looks like this. It's all fish-eyed lenses and weirdness, and it's a film that Orson Welles would understand pictorially more so than a James Whale.
Now, one of these films I have missed. How is it possible I have never seen The Invisible Ray, and what have I missed by not seeing it?
The Invisible Ray is the bounce back, if you will, from The Black Cat and The Raven, which came out the next year, 1935, in which you have Lugosi doing his thing again, but he's even more manic, and there are torture chambers and everything like that. And Universal said, okay, you two, you mad ghouls, both of you, let's pull this back a little bit and get you in a science fiction picture. So it's very H.G. Wells. It's horror, but one thing that Universal would do at the time is they would shoehorn a lot of things into the horror genre. And you'll look at these pictures now, and they were billed that way, and they don't have this eldritch aspect to them. And The Invisible Ray was along those lines. It's a more subtle, it's a quieter film. If it was going to have a horror analog, it's more in keeping with something like The Mummy than Bride of Frankenstein. It's understated. And at the time, technology was very scary to people. It's scary to people like me now because I'm inept with it. But this was all New Deal stuff at the time. And so they're also riffing off that idea of like, hey, these gadgets can zap you and end you. And wouldn't that just be awful for you?
One of the things that excited me about this collection when you sent it to me is because you and I are both big old-time radio fans today, being National Radio Day as well, that part of the collection is an old episode of The Inner Sanctum with Karloff doing The Telltale Heart. That sounds amazing.
Karloff was, he was excellent on the radio. Lugosi was not on the radio that often because Lugosi, of course, had the accent and he learned English phonetically. And he needed to sink those chompers of his into set and just chew away massively. That was what he did. He overacted. In fact, when he launches into his speeches in The Black Cat, there's this great soundtrack. A lot of it's Franz Liszt. There's a Schubert, Eighth Unfinished Symphony. When Lugosi starts doing his thing, the soundtrack stops because Ulmer's like, I can't compete with this guy. Shut the music off. Let him go. But Karloff did so much radio, and a lot of these actors at the time, right up into the end of the 1940s, they're doing double duty on the radio. I, for instance, belong to a Red Sox discussion forum, and they put up a game post, so people are going to talk about the game as it unfurls in real time. And because they're playing the Phillies today, somebody wrote the Philadelphia story. I thought, oh, you know what? I could post on there. There is a great radio version of the Philadelphia story. Any film that you like from this time period often has a radio version of it. The Uninvited, which we both like and we've spoken about, there is a great radio version of that. And you can see here, rather, how something along those lines that condensed into a half hour. You can hear things like Judy Garland years after the fact of Wizard of Oz, on Christmas Day, 11, 12 years later, reprising the role of Dorothy and how she gives different inflections to different lines. And Karloff was very much a vocal actor. That's why he works so well in How the Grinch Stole Christmas, right?
Right.
He's that vocal actor, always with the command of the language.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. We played a little Miles Davis from Kind of Blue, a 60th anniversary this year. Is it the album that people have, even if they're not sure they really like jazz?
It is. If you only have one jazz LP, it's probably going to be this. If you are a hipster who goes out on a date, some frou-frou place in Brooklyn, and you're like, oh, yes, I hope to go to Yaddo and birth my latest microfiction collection. Have you ever heard Kind of Blue? Yeah, this is going to be the record you reference. And it is dogged by something that I think of as sacred cow syndrome. And we see this more and more all the time now, where something just becomes dun-dun-dun, it is this almighty thing, and then it's never revisited again because we are such slothful creatures in so many different ways. And so I don't think that does a service to the album, the art, whatever it might be, even if it is that dun-dun-dun, the best ever thing. And I don't think Miles Davis would have told you this was his best ever thing. Miles Davis would have been rip bleep. If you said that to him, he would have said, hey, I reinvented music like six or seven other times. He might have said Bitches Brew. He might have said the very radical birth of the cool. He might have said something that he did with the second great quintet. But what you have here is a kind of one-off, in a way, with this particular sextet. And he had his first great quintet, and John Coltrane was in that band, and Coltrane is carried over into this unit as well. You have Miles Davis with Bill Evans, the pianist, who he's not really going to work with again. They do a couple live dates, and I've written about those because this band wasn't as tight as the first great quintet. It wasn't as tight as the second great quintet that's going to follow later in 63, 64, 65, Tony Williams on drums and Wayne Shorter on tenor. That band is one of the tightest bands in the history of small ensemble jazz. This band was not quite that tight, but Davis hit upon a solution. And the solution, which he turned a weakness into a strength with, was everybody soloed off of the chord changes in a given song. Listen to something like Charlie Parker. He's playing that bebop. He's playing it so fast, but he's soloing off the chord changes. And Davis said, let's base things off of modes, off of scales. And that was completely different. And it was freeing. And you also didn't have to interact quite the same way with your bandmates. You didn't have to gel these guys could all play at phenomenal levels, everybody here. But there's more to that than being a jazz unit. And they didn't necessarily have that tightness, I don't feel. And Davis, he was that guy. He was that Bill Belichick. Although he's playing trumpet, he is still the coach. He is the conductor. And he's saying, this is what we're going to do. He's not letting these guys study the music before they play. And they're thinking through a lot of it in their head, and they're realizing that in their instruments. And what you get from that is an emphasis on melody. And people love melody. The reason why the Beatles are the Beatles and did what they did, sure, there's great messages and everything, but it's melody. Schubert, melody. Mozart, melody. Handel with Messiah. Think of the melody. Think of the melody of the Nutcracker. It's always melody, and Miles Davis, especially on this record, had the gift for melody.
But you write, Colin, that sometimes Davis did his best work when he was paying more attention to rhythm than melody or anything else.
If he was a guitarist, he would have been a great rhythm guitarist. And Davis had a genius for lacuna, for silence, for gaps in music. And he got a lot of this from a pianist named Ahmad Jamal, and Davis would go to see him every chance he got in Chicago. And Jamal would have no problem using silence as sound. Thelonious Monk did that too. And don't forget that Monk paired so memorably with Coltrane. So Coltrane learned to build silence into his music as well. Like when you're writing something, when you're reading something great, note what happens in the space of a paragraph. Now, there are no words in that space of the paragraph, but when one paragraph ends, before the next one begins, there is a twist of meaning within that white parchment interval. Something happens. Something is encoded into that centimeter of space. And Davis was able to do that with his music. And sometimes he would just lay out and let these guys go because he didn't want to impose upon what they were doing. Then he'd jump in and he'd shape the sound that way and they'd say, oh, that's the direction we're going in. So he was a pathbreaker and he didn't play with ego, even though he had an ego bigger than all of outdoors with the rest of the party.
Kind of Blue is great, but as you suggested, if you want to know more about Miles Davis, maybe explore things like Milestones, Jazz at the Plaza, what you refer to as the Blue Clusters.
Yes, and Milestones from the year before is I think it's a more rewarding listening experience, but it might not be your gateway into jazz. So think about the things, the books you like or the records you like, or even just a given band. There are certain bands where it's better to start with whatever the record might be. It might be better to start with London Calling, say, than Sandinista. And that's kind of what Milestones was. But Milestones, he hits upon this idea of this modal jazz, of getting away from these solos based off of the chord changes. And you can, it's the sound of a world opening up to somebody, but it's still in that pocket quasi hard bop groove. But Davis never played hard bop. Hard bop was what you would have heard at the dive bar, whether you were white, whether you were black. Jimmy Smith, it was Hank Mobley, it was groove, it was R&B, it was proto-soul, and you danced your ass off to it. And Davis had elements of hard bop, but he was more working this vein of post-bop that was endemic to him. And Milestones is great. The Newport set with this band is great. They go to the Plaza in New York hotel, and they cut a jazz party. And it's a chance to hear this live band figuring out this stuff that they're going to realize. And it's just the embryonic version of what became the full blue flowering of this particular work of art.
Nobody else in the business can take you on a seamless tour from Tony Armas through Bela Lugosi to Miles Davis. Colin Fleming, we thank you as always, my friend.
Okay, thank you, sir.